100 history.
Just one more time. So we actually came up with a name which we think is a very good name for the book. It has no subtitle, but we want to call it The Post-Compulsion. Sorry. And post, of course, is in inverted commas to signal that it is an adjective. It is the kind of compulsion that we think people have that we are trying to diagnose. So it's the post-compulsion. Subtitle. So it's compulsory in the sense that you have to do it, but it's also this urge to do it. So perhaps the subtitle for this little thing, which has to be rewritten. What we have here is our springboard piece that got our discussion going, followed by 10 points of things that need to be interpolated into that, and there'll be other things as well. But this, to put up on the website to give our colleagues who are not here some sense of where the introduction might be going. And the subtitle, thanks to Hannah, for this section is The Omnipresent Post and the Elusive Now. If our project began as an exercise in systematically comparing post-socialist and post-colonial literature and social scientific teaching and writing, proving why these two bodies of literature have been kept so artificially separate, dominated by disparate models, concepts, and research concerns, our endeavors have evolved in unanticipated ways. While recognizing that much of the post-socialist world was a very clearly articulated colonial project, and many parts of the post-colony had or came to have socialist regimes, the mutual interrogation of these paradigms, or their possible recombination, proved insufficient for the various tasks our disciplines demanded of us. That is to say, it was the very inadequacy of a reformulation of either or both paradigms which proved most instructive by the conclusion of our 3+ years of collaboration. The insufficiency of post-periodization could be explored from a variety of perspectives. First, there is the polarization of these positions along two incommensurable axes. On the one hand, common sense similarities between culturally, geographically, and historically disparate contexts sometimes suggest that both colonialism and socialism were, in inverted quotes, consummate technologies of power. Regimes so unified in their motivations and practices, they left uniform imprints on the societies they organized. Certainly, backfield discussions about conditions of life and intellectual production under Fidel Castro, Tito, and Ceausescu make affable and sometimes even compelling dinner conversations that can be translated into broad theoretical generalizations with dangerous ease. On the other hand, exploration of the specificities of individual cases, even the differences between the Bosnian experience of socialism under Tito and subsequent independence, as compared to the Slovenian experience, for example, could lead one in the opposite direction. Suddenly, colonialism and socialism both seem challenged by entrenched provincialism, durable and sturdy mentalities that persist beneath the homogeneities imposed by socialist and colonial regimes, only to reemerge when these impositions are stripped away and each new nation-state must chase progress, pull towards that center of gravity that is Western neoliberal polity. In this model, societies or cultures are almost trapped inside of their cultural template, forever destined to repetition, as they can only encounter the new in a fixed matrix of cultural reflexes, C.F. Stalin. One is not so much of a place, but trapped in that place, which is also their culture, their worldview, C.F. Apadurai. Forever out of sync with a history which comes from outside and can only be incorporated with limited success due to its exterior character. Both of these approaches have temporal corollaries. Socialism is about continuity, something that, as Yurchak put it, was forever until it was no more. The task for these post-socialist nations, then, is to make the jump, to find the means to effect the necessary level of rupture, to be pulled over the threshold into Western modernity so long denied them. Post-colonial states, by contrast, face a different problem. The violence of colonialism is presumed to be so absolute that no cultural or historical continuity remains possible. Post-colonial studies, then, in this guise, is the effort to analyze all responses to absolute schism, even those undertaken during the time of colonialism itself, C.F. Aluwalia. How could either characterization be true when so much of the world cannot be exclusively compartmentalized as either post-socialist or post-colonial? And who escapes the dual bind of a crippling continuity or discontinuity here? only the so-called West, which seems afforded the luxury of a creative and adaptive existence inside of linear time. Unsatisfied with the contrary pulls which underpin these paradigms, and increasingly unconvinced that it could ever suffice to simply approach them critically, our collaboration sought new directions and impetuses. The common denominator that did seem to emerge from our discussion was that post-socialists and post-colonials alike were modernist manqués, peoples whose politics and social evolution were always coeval, but also always temporally out of joint with an imagined West. Perhaps those paradigms were simply elaborate instantiations of what Fabian termed allochronic practices, which allow the West to construct its other. As Fabian argues, this intellectual process insists on parallel temporal idioms, that of chronological time, which posits us all as contemporaries in the empty chronology of geological time, and that of periodic time, a time one cannot date universally, but which assumes its features from the befores and afters of binary opposition. Pre-literate-literate, pre-industrial-industrial, pre-modern-modern, or even pre-socialist-socialist, or pre-colonial-colonial. If this is so, there is little abuse that can be recuperated from these paradigms that would prove elucidating. They are both ultimately epistemes of Western hegemony whose mobilization serves more to fix the terms of reference by which histories, modernities, and social realities can be understood in solely Western terms than wholly viable conduct for rethinking the now in which allegedly post-socialist and post-colonial societies find themselves. So where to begin this rethinking of the now after post-periodization? We started our efforts by thinking through the sense of delay, the enduring limbo in which many of these societies find themselves, always chasing progress, always sitting restlessly in the waiting room of history. But our explorations began to reveal something more invidious. There was no room for any neutral description of processes of history, because so many are actually caught up in a project of history's teleological redelineation. As one colleague so aptly put it, we're not in the waiting room of history, but very concretely in its operating room. So our job became an endeavor to investigate liberal democracy in the now, its shapes and forms, its subjectivities and imperial moorings, and the very material ways in which these enunciate with the specificities of the now and those sites being operated on. It is not coincidental that these operations are so often cited in contexts of conflict and genocide, where the very purpose of such extreme violence is to break social ties, social memories, and all sense of community in itself that predated the outbreak of atrocities. No one is suggesting that such extreme cases of violence have been engineered in order to serve a pre-imagined outcome. But it is equally true that the aftermath of such scenarios leaves the ground ripe for a series of interventions which go worryingly unproblematized and justify themselves by attaching the causes of such violence to tribal sentiments which resurface the post-socialist context, or an inability to reconcile earlier attempts to drag societies into modern civilization, the post-colonial context. By attending to the ways in which such events constitute identities rather than spring from them, by insisting that these identities are not best apprehended or diffused with recourse to a neoliberal agenda, and with the humility to learn comparatively from our disparate lived experiences without turning to speak back to the West and through the organs of its epistemology, we've come a long way in 3.5 years, a journey we hope is reflected in the contributions that follow. To be interpolated in no particular order, one, underline what is the uptake of these bodies of literature to the situations where we research rather than an examination of those situations per se. Two, what are the various posts at play, post-Cold War, Verdery, post-liberalism, Fukuyama, or post-genocide, post-conflict, post-Dayton. Three, what are the implications of the concept of transition? Socialism was once a stepping stone to communism, which meant the post-socialists were once ahead of history as compared to the capitalist societies, Lenin, Marx. Now, communism is seen as an aberration, a distraction that has left the post-socialists behind the game. Four, how to grasp complexities in a different way without recourse to periodization. Five, is there a post-modernity? What is a process and what is a project? People in post-socialism are not using the same diagnosis. Who defines the next post, and why does social science succumb to these dichotomies? How are they biological in the ways they articulate nationalism, or still part of a scientific project of enlightenment? Six, how is nostalgia structured and why? In what ways is Europe an empty signifier to fill the lack which nostalgia requires? Seven, how is every theoretical step forward also a recycling? Where does the lack of imagination for dreaming the now come from? Postcolonialism was originally driven by economic models, Wallerstein, Frank, and came to be dominated by identity politics, subaltern studies. So too, post-socialism mirrors this move from economic diagnoses to identity-driven diagnoses. 8. Can Baba's idea of vernacular cosmopolitanism breach the confines of post-periodization, or does it simply re-sketch these overly facile presumptions under a spatial guise? 9. What is the legacy of possessive individualism, and how does it collide with intellectual concerns around equality? What is enabling and what is debilitating about this concept as an analytic frame? And 10. Does knowledge always have to be ex post facto, or can we really imagine the now?
We have somebody here.